I'm going to try to share my screen now. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Does everybody see that?
Yes.
Okay, NDAs. Okay, so I'll just get right into this. For starters, this is intended to be an overview, and as such, it shouldn't be a substitute for an actual non-disclosure agreement, because each situation is a little case specific. You don't want to just take what you're seeing right here and use that as the basis for an agreement, because in the short span of time I have, I don't have time to cover everything. So this is intended to give you the big nuggets, the bullet points, if you will. And there are a lot of boilerplate standard language provisions that go in these agreements, and we won't get to all of those. And so that's what this disclaimer is about. So the overview is regarding the underlying purposes and why might you want a non-disclosure agreement or an NDA. One of them is probably the most obvious, and that's to keep information from your competitors. And I think that just goes without saying. If you want to keep recipients of information contractually obligated to not disclose the information, then this is the best way to do it. The next reason is preservation of intellectual property rights, and specifically patents and trade secrets. And as we'll see in a little while, if you don't take certain steps to preserve the confidentiality of certain information, you can lose some or all of your intellectual property rights. And so this is becomes very important in this context. And that sort of dovetails into the next point, which is to prevent devaluation of IP assets. And as you guys are forming companies, you should be aware of or trying to commercialize inventions. That's intellectual property. And you might have an invention, you might file a patent application, you might come up with some clever trade names or some other types of marketing or brand equity. It's all intellectual property, and it adds value to the corporation. And so you don't want to unnecessarily lose those rights merely because you've not taken the appropriate steps to keep your information confidential. So when it comes to patents, the U.S. is a little different than most other countries, but they are the same in that the U.S. and foreign patents can be invalidated by certain public disclosures. So for instance, if you have an idea for an invention and you create a website and you put that invention up there on the website, that's a public disclosure. If you make a prototype, let's say you have a widget, and do we use the term widget these days, or does your generation use that term? I don't know. But we'll call it a widget, and let's say you have a widget, and you've created a prototype, and you bring it to class, and you offer to sell it to somebody. That is a public offer for sale, and either of those two events can trigger the public disclosure clock that'll start ticking. So what's fortunate is in the U.S. you have a one-year safe harbor. So if you disclose your invention to the public or make it publicly known or offer it for sale, you have 1 year to get a filing date for your patent. Now, in Europe, for example, which is the third bullet point, there is no such safe harbor. So if you do not have if you're not patent pending by the time that you make that public disclosure, it's fatal. You do no longer have the right to apply for a patent in Europe and, in fact, many other countries. So the U.S. has that safe harbor, which is nice. I think Canada and Australia might have that too. The bottom line is, coming back to the non-disclosure agreements, is you're well advised to make sure that any disclosure is covered by an NDA. Anybody you show it to signs one of these. And then you don't have to sweat if you don't get that patent filed right away. Because any of these things that are a public disclosure, if it's covered by an NDA, it's no longer a public disclosure. Trade secrets, on the other hand, you don't lose the right to file a patent, because with a trade secret, you have made a conscious decision to not pursue patent protection. Instead, you're going to keep it a secret. And for instance, the recipe for Coca-Cola, if that were patentable and Coca-Cola would have gotten a patent on that, it would have only lasted about 17 years. And then the rest of the world would have had the recipe for Coke, because patents have limited duration, between 17 to 20 years, roughly. So Coke made the decision to preserve that recipe as a trade secret, and a trade secret can last forever. However, if you're going to take legal action against somebody for stealing your trade secrets, if you have not taken the appropriate steps to keep the secrets, or to keep the information secret, then that negatively affects your ability to go after somebody for stealing your trade secrets. And so the NDA is a tool that you can use, one of the tools that you can use to do that. And trade secrets gets a little more complicated, because you have to have an internal corporate policy about dissemination of information and so on. But this is one of the big considerations. Okay, so preliminary considerations: have these NDAs signed as soon as possible, preferably before you disclose. Now, that might sound obvious to you guys, but oftentimes people come to us and they give us their situation, and we say, well, do you have an NDA in place? And they say no. And then we have to go back retroactively and try to get people to sign the NDA, which is great if you can do it. But the problem is, after the information has been disclosed, the recipient is not under a legal obligation to keep that information confidential. Now, they may decide to sign the NDA just to cooperate, or because they want to be paid or what have you. But you do create a risk that they may not sign these agreements. So it goes without saying that you need to have these NDAs signed ahead of time. Now, unilateral or mutual, that has to do with who's disclosing information. If you're the one with the invention and you want to go to, let's say, a potential investor to raise money, or you want to go to a fabricator to have your widget made, you want to make sure that they agree to maintain the confidentiality of the information that you're going to give them. Now, on the other hand, and so that would be an example of a unilateral disclosure. Mutual disclosure is, let's say two of you in that class are thinking about joining forces because one of you has the widget and another has a different type of invention or a different type of company, and you found some synergy, some ways that you can work together. In that case, you've got a two-way or a mutual exchange of information, and an NDA would be two-way. In other words, both sides are agreeing to maintain the confidentiality of the information. Now, this third bullet point is, if you are not in that type of a situation where there's a mutual disclosure, then the starting point for you should be unilateral. In other words, you don't want to go to that fabricator and say and make promise that you are not going to disclose anything they tell you, because why would you unnecessarily legally obligate yourself to such a thing? So my point is to make the NDA unilateral unless there's a reason to not do so. Okay, and so keep in mind here when we talk about contents that we, the disclaimer at the beginning, these are not, this is not a comprehensive list of contents, rather it's the sort of the big bullet points. There are a lot of other provisions that are not in here that will be part of a standard agreement that was really beyond the scope of this, this brief overview. And so what we have, we'll go through each of these separately. Parties to the agreement, I think that goes without saying. These are the individuals or business entities that are entering into the agreement. So if you have a unilateral NDA, it's going to have your name on it, but you're not signing in terms of making a legal promise to not disclose information, but you still are listed in the agreement. And in fact, you do not have to sign the agreement. You can have your name on it, and the signature block at the end of the agreement just has the recipient's signature. And so you are not signing anything, and in fact, you don't have to. Affiliates and representatives, there are when you have a larger company, you're going to have to share information within the company. But at the same time, it's a good idea that not only are you limiting the individuals who are allowed to see the information, but you are also getting everybody on the hook. So the NDA might limit the dissemination of information to only those people who need to know, let's say the engineering group, but not the marketing group, even though the company as a whole is legally obligated to not disclose information, you're still restricting it. And it is generally a good idea to have such a restriction in place because it helps you to maintain control of the information and it helps you to preserve your right to argue that you have not unnecessarily compromised the information. Business purpose, this may not seem as obvious, but consider limiting the disclosure to a specific business purpose, such as to evaluate a potential joint venture. So if there are disagreements down the road, it could help you later on if you've taken such steps to limit disclosure in because if you're if you've got a disclosure that's made beyond the scope of the agreement, it helps your. Hello? Can I hear someone else talking? Can everybody still hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Hello, this is Steve.
Steve, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here, Ron.
Okay. All right. Okay, we're doing okay on time. So now we're into the contents portion and the definition of confidential information. And this can be a pretty big set, a pretty big list of information. And as I say here, it should be defined broadly enough to cover all the information might disclose as well as any that may have been previously disclosed. Yeah. And when I say previously disclosed,
but let me ask you this.
Sure, go ahead.
Would that be okay? Is this the best number to reach on?
Is who is that that's talking?
Just a moment, and I'll call you right back after.
Is that Steve? Hey, Steve, could you mute your microphone?
I apologize. I didn't think I was live there. Huh?
Okay, that's what I thought. I turned my video off, so I really can't see anything anymore. I got it going in. Okay. So we're into the definition of confidential information. And so when you have an agreement like this, you sort of want to draw some boundaries around what it is you're going to disclose. Is it a computer program? Is it a chemical formula? Is it a customer list? We lawyers tend to put a paragraph in here that has everything but the kitchen sink in there. And that's just lawyers by nature trying to cover everything. But just so you know, if it's too broad, a court might have the ability and might be inclined to sort of strike certain provisions. But you do need to put some thought into it and think about what it is, what type of information you're going to disclose, and at least list that. Again, avoid being overly broad so it doesn't look ridiculous and you don't have the create the risk that a court might strike it. Generally one paragraph, and I'm going to show you right here, as you can see, and I don't know if that font is too small for you guys to see or not, but I won't bore you by reading the whole thing. But what you can see here is it's a very diverse list. I mean, we have business and marketing plans, employee and contractor lists and records. I'll just give you another example. The customer list and how much you're making from each customer is pretty important. So if you have two competitors that are agreeing to work together under a certain situation or in a joint venture, you don't necessarily want to tell your competitors how much you're paying for the raw materials or the parts, and you don't necessarily want them to know what your profits are. And so those are some examples of some information that you want to keep confidential. In a real basic example would be just the patent. The patent application may not have been published yet, and you're going to let your the recipient of the information see the patent. You're just going to hand it to them and say, this is our patent, and it's confidential until such time as it's published. And if you allow your patent to publish, then it becomes public knowledge and there's no longer a legal obligation to keep it confidential. Duration, how long does the receiving party have to keep this information confidential? What I see a lot is 5 years, but as I say here, it could be indefinite depending on the situation. If the situation warrants it, then certainly you can adjust that time frame. But you wouldn't want to make it too short for certainly. But in the sense of a patent only lasts for 20 years. And once a patent issues, it's published for the world to see. So it doesn't make too much sense to create a legal obligation for someone to keep a patent secret when it's already published. So that's that third bullet point there, until such time as it becomes public by external factors. Miscellaneous provisions, we're sort of bringing this thing in for a landing right here. I won't go through all of these, but this slide, and I believe the next slide, things that aren't covered and exclusions from the definition. So you have this long list of things that are considered to be confidential, customer lists or whatever, but certain things are excluded. Look at that first one. Is or becomes public other than through a breach of the agreement by the recipient. So if that patent application gets published, it's no longer covered by this agreement. If the information becomes published some other way, not through no fault of the recipient, then they're not legally obligated to keep it confidential anymore. It's just a sort of a common sense provision. That second one's kind of important. Was already in the recipient's possession or was available to the recipient. So let's say you're disclosing a chemical formula and come to find out that the recipient was already in possession of that formula through their own investigation or research. And if they can demonstrate that that was in fact the case, then they would not be legally obligated to maintain that confidentiality through this agreement because they already knew about it. So I'm right at the 20-minute mark here. Let's see here. I have quite a bit here that I'm not going to get through, but I'm going to go ahead and stop here. That's me. Phone number and email. If you guys have any questions, we can go ahead and field those right now.
Stuart, have you ever heard of a situation where somebody signs an NDA and then goes on to be involved in the patent? Is there some implied ownership when you're under an NDA, or is it are you still free to kind of work on the project and then be on the patent that's filed for your contribution?
They sign an NDA and then they do what?
Essentially, they just help develop the IP further from there. So when you file the patent, the provisional patents, and their name is on it, is that something that can conflict? Have you ever heard of?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, it can be fixed when it comes to patents. Not just anybody can be listed as an inventor. The actual inventor is the only one that is legally entitled to be listed as the inventor. And so if you disclose this information to somebody and they go run and file a patent application, there is a procedure in place to challenge their inventorship. And so that's what you would have to do in that situation. Unfortunately, our laws have just changed recently. And now it is literally a race to the patent office. Whereas prior to, I believe, 2013, you could prove that you're the first one to think of it. You had the concept, the fully defined concept before the other person. Thus, you have priority. But now it's that filing date that is gives you priority. Unfortunately, you do still have the ability to challenge somebody's inventorship.
Okay, and you talked about a difference between NDA safe harbors and public disclosure safe harbors. Can you elaborate more on that? What constitutes public disclosure?
And again, the safe harbor is just in the context of the United States. Let's just use a computer program, for instance. That you believe is patentable or that might in fact be patentable. And you put that, let's say you send out a bid to have somebody implement that somehow on some kind of firmware or something like that. That is a public disclosure. So in the U.S., you still have 1 year from that date to file. But in Europe, you no longer have the ability to file because you've already made it public. And so the safe harbor has to do with how long you have to file after making the public disclosure. Now, an offer for sale is a public disclosure, and that's not an offer to sell the rights to the patent. That is an offer to sell the widget. Making it public by putting it up on a website, if you just use it in public, and I think one of the cases that we studied in law school was somebody tried to patent a bra, and they said, well, the bra wasn't in public because it was underneath somebody's sweater, but nevertheless, it's still public use. So it's you get into some legal wrangling when you're trying to argue about whether something was public disclosure or not. But if you are, there are exceptions like experimentation. If you said, well, we had to take this, we had this airplane and we had to take it out and test it to see if it would fly, but we weren't quite done inventing it yet. That is an example of an exception where it is, it's an experimental public disclosure. And so you avoid that problem. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, very well, thanks.
Anyone else?
I'm going to throw one out there.
Okay.
What do you say to people who are starting to talk to venture capitalists, and venture capitalists will pretty much not sign NDAs? What is your general, counsel to your clients in that situation?
Well, if you and Chris Mayer, you could jump in here too if you had some insight, but if a VC is unwilling to sign an NDA and you want money that they're offering, I guess you don't really have a choice. However, you still need to be aware of the public disclosures that can cause you to lose your patent rights. In such a case, if you had a VC that was unwilling to sign, then you couldn't disclose it until you made sure you got the patent application. So I guess in that situation, you would just make sure you file the patent first, then you can disclose it to a VC who is unwilling to sign an NDA.
Yeah, Laurie, I would say, I think it's typical. What I see is investors not willing to sign an NDA. So I would say that's just a warning to entrepreneurs and founders, understanding that they have no protection and that they have to be very cognizant of that when entering into the situation. And I think what that means in practice is that you should disclose only enough information to move yourself along in the process of getting an investment, and not so much that party could, as actually does happen, I think I will come out and say that, use that information to help another portfolio company, right? Because if you disclose something and they have investments in a very similar portfolio company, they can take that information and absolutely pass it along to that company. There's nothing preventing them from doing so. And my anecdotal experience is that happens.
Coming back to the point earlier about public stuff being kind of public disclosure, if you're talking to venture capitalists, then should you avoid a demonstration? Should you avoid showing them what you have until you know whether or not they'll sign an NDA? Or is that something that you have to take a risk on?
Well, there is one little technique you can use that's called a provisional patent application. Assuming we're talking about something that's patentable, you can quickly file an incomplete patent application that doesn't have to comply with all the rigid formalities of a non-provisional patent application. For a provisional, you can literally upload hand sketches or hand notes or drawings that are, done it informally, and you could do that very quickly and inexpensively. So if you are in a situation like that and you do believe that you've got some confidential or some things that should be confidential, you can bundle it up in a provisional patent application, get that filed, and then disclose the information. Even if later you find out that it's not patentable, at least you, as of the filing date, you had taken those steps. But ultimately, if you've got somebody that's trustworthy and is going to get out there and try and exploit you, there are legal remedies that you can take advantage of in addition to the patent laws, such as unfair trade practices and other common law remedies that are available from state to state.
So, Ron, I think we have to leave it there give Steve a time to cover the topic and for at least a question.
Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Ron.
Yep. Thank you.
So, Steve, if you want to engage the share screen feature.
I just did that, Christopher. Can you see me okay?
I see you, but I don't see your screen.
Okay, let's see.
Go to the bottom.
It says I'm, let's see, okay, I'm. How's
there
that?
Yeah, it's starting. Okay, there we go. Understanding IP. Can you give us the full screen version?
I hope so. I do not have, I'm having some issues with my video feed here.
Can you here?
Let me see. Hold on just a moment.
Reading view over there to the left. Reading view. There you go. That should do it.
How's that?
Hey.
Perfect.
Okay. Now that we've got those out of the way, I don't know if you can see me or if you can just see the screen. I assume you can see both. It's nice to be with you. I'm Steve Reinhardt, and I am partners with Chris Amir, who's on with us here, and with Ron, who just spoke. And I am connecting to you from Salt Lake City. It's snowing here. It makes me wish I were in California. I'm there now once a month, although I can see you all are wearing jackets, so maybe it's cold there too. I'm not sure. But I am an intellectual property attorney with Vested Law. We've got several of them. Ron is one as well. And the focus of my practice, we're not really supposed to say specialty as attorneys, but one of the focuses of my practice is internet law. Now, as entrepreneurs, you have all kinds of things you got to learn and worry about. I mean, NDAs are just one of a thousand things that you need to be aware of. You've got to worry about VCs. I've dealt with VCs a lot. And in our emerging world, trademarks have never been more important, and domain names. And as an intellectual property attorney, you know, I deal with intellectual property, obviously, all day. That includes patents. It includes trademarks. It includes copyrights. And a version of a trademark is a domain name. It can be looked at that way. And so what I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today is picking a domain name and protecting it. And you may say, well, it's easy. All you have to do is just go register the domain. It's not quite that easy. There are legal processes in place for seizing domain names from other parties. And it's what I do all the time. Now, to begin with, domain names have an increasing, they have value that is increasing like I've never seen before. Last year, let me give you some examples of what domain names sold for. Now, these are just the domain names, not the associated businesses with them. They didn't have businesses associated with them. Beard.com sold for $7 million. Porno.com sold for $9 million. Now, this is just the domain name. The domain name YP.com, YankeePapa.com, sold for $3.8 million. That's just the domain name. Any two-letter domain is worth more than $1 million, probably more than $2 million. And any three-letter domain is worth more than $200,000. It doesn't matter what it is. The domain 360.com sold for $4 million last year. I myself have done the legal work for domain transactions that have been in excess of $1 million. And oftentimes businesses, the domain name is their most valuable asset. It's an asset like a car or a truck or inventory. And if the domain name is lost, if you pick a domain name that is taken or successfully seized by another party, you can lose all the goodwill associated with your business, all of it. And I can give you some examples. I had a client 3 or 4 years ago who owned the domain name EZQ.com, EchoZuluQuebec.com, and it was stolen by a hacker in China. I quickly had to seek a restraining order in court, try to get the domain back. I'm dealing with that same situation right now with the domain CostaRica.com. It was stolen by a hacker, and I'm handling litigation to try and recover it. And that domain is very valuable. It's probably worth a couple of million. My clients registered it in 1995, when the internet was in its infancy, for $10. If you had registered all the dot coms, the two-letter and three-letter dot coms back in 95, you would be the richest man in the world now. I mean, you would be worth tens of billions of dollars. That's how much these domain names can be worth. So I want to try to give you some practical advice for picking a domain name. As you start your business, there are two approaches you can take to picking a domain name. And one is you can pick a domain name that describes your product or service. For instance, greatrestaurant.com. If you were starting a restaurant, it's a domain name that just describes the restaurant. The restaurant is great. Or you can pick a domain name that is distinctive, such as Google. When Google registered Google.com, it was a word that they had coined themselves. Nobody had heard of it. The search engines will pick up and rank websites quicker that have descriptive names, like Great Restaurant, than they will websites that have distinctive names, like Google. But ultimately, you have more protection over your domain name, and you can prevent others from copying you more easily if your domain name is distinctive. So if you want to develop a brand, the best thing to do is to pick a domain name that's distinctive and not just merely descriptive of the products or services that you're offering. Now, there are all kinds of problems that domain name owners, small business owners, entrepreneurs face when starting a business. For instance, other competitors may register a domain that's similar to your domain. They may impersonate you. WellsFargo.com, the bank, had a problem where someone registered WellsFargo.net and pretended they were them, got all kinds of information from their customers. That's called phishing. Cyber squatting is where someone registers your business name and reflects it in all kinds of internet domain names that you don't own. For instance, if someone registered google.net, google.info, google.org, that would be cyber squatting. Typo squatting is where someone registers a version of your domain name that's misspelled or that represents a common misspelling of the domain name, and then they pretend that they're you. If somebody does that, you can take the domain name from them. And you can do it through two methods. You can file what's called a UDRP action, or you can file in federal court an ACPA action. Now, both of these cases are easier to win if your domain name is distinctive than if it's descriptive. Many people don't realize, and I would assume probably none of you realize this, just based on what I see out there, that when you register a domain name, it's not yours necessarily. Another party can file with an ICANN-approved dispute resolution provider a simple complaint, which is decided within 30 days, to take the domain from you, regardless of what you paid for it. There are people who've paid $50,000 for domain names that I'm aware of, who've lost them within 30 days when another party simply asserts they have rights in it. And I handle these cases all the time. I've done over 200 of them where I try and take domain names from other parties. By the same token, if you register a domain name that infringes the trademark of another party, or incorporates the brand name of another party, you could lose that domain name. It's never been more important for entrepreneurs to do a clearance search at the trademark office before setting up a business, before registering a domain name, to make sure that there's not another party who has trademark rights in your brand name or your mark, your domain name, that could successfully take the domain name from you after you register. And the UDRP, the Uniform Domain Name Resolution Policy, it's a set of rules that everybody who registers a .com or a GTLD, a generic top-level domain, .net, .org, .info, has to agree to. You don't realize it probably, but you agree to this anytime with any domain that you've registered. And it's just a set of rules where you agree to participate in this arbitration, this arbitrative proceeding, if somebody challenges your ownership of the domain. Now, you can also go after the registrant of a domain in federal court under the Anti-Cyber Squatting and Consumer Protection Act. In that case, you can get not just the domain, but also money damages. You can get money from the person who's registered it if they're infringing your rights. It's very distressing for my clients to find out, those who I'm defending, that a domain name they've invested in and been using for sometimes years can just be so easily taken from them in one of these types of proceedings. Even if the registrant of a domain name is overseas and they've never stepped foot in the U.S., they have a website that's not in English, the domain name can still be taken from them. They often think they're safe outside of U.S. jurisdiction. But U.S. law says that you can go after the domain name where it's physically located. Well, you say, where is the domain physically located? This is fiction. The law says it's in Virginia at the registry, the .com registry, which directs traffic for .coms and is controlled by VeriSign. So I'm licensed in Virginia, and I'm often going after individuals overseas who've registered domain names that incorporate U.S. trademarks and who think they're safe from U.S. courts, and they're not. I know that time is a little bit short, and I know that I just rambled a little bit, but I want to make sure that I answer any questions with the time that we have that you may have. Do any of you students, Lori, have questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, so I have a question. If you say you make a brand name, right? Because I know people grab up a bunch of domain names just to try to sell them to make money.
That's yes.
So like I made a product and I came up with the name and someone's, you know, cyber squatting the name of my product, .com. So is there anything you can do about that or no?
So you're saying that you've created a product and then somebody has the domain, somebody who's registered a lot of domains is just sitting on it.
That's correct. There's no content on the domain. It's just simply there to be squatted on.
You can take that domain from that cyber squatter.
Okay. Yeah. This cyber squatter is in Australia. I sent him a cease and desist, but he didn't do anything. So I'm thinking about maybe trying to get it some other way.
So many of the domain names in the world are registered by parties overseas. Korea, Russia, Grand Cayman Islands is a big one. And the law would be very shallow if there weren't a way to recover domain names from cyber squatters overseas. So you can file a UDRP action, which takes only 30 days. All the registrants overseas have agreed to be bound by it. Or you could sue the registrant in Virginia in federal court, exercising what's called in rem jurisdiction over the property itself. And so either of those ways, probably the UDRP is the cheapest, most effective, can be used to take the domain from this person. Now, you have to show that you have trademark rights in the domain, but that doesn't mean you have to have a registered trademark. Just use of a brand name in commerce gives rise to what's called a common law trademark, which is just a trademark that arises automatically through use of a brand name. Now, of course, there are defenses to these cases. I'd have to know the specifics about your situation to know if you'd prevail or to advise you on that. But you, You're not without remedy. You can fix this situation.
To file, I was looking, was it like $2,000 to file that complaint?
The filing fee for the UDRP case is $1,300. Okay. It's $1,500 if you file in Europe. You can pick where you want to go. The National Arbitration Forum is the U.S. authority that handles it. And the attorney's fees vary, but you'd probably be looking at $2,500 in attorney's fees. So it's about a $3,800 problem if you want to try to resolve it legally.
Yeah, that's the hard part with starting out, you know, with no money.
I know it. It's hard. It's hard being a college student, and yeah, you often find yourself in a situation where you have to have venture capital to proceed.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions from anybody?
Yeah, can you hear me back here, Steve?
I can, yes.
Okay, cool. So if you have like a pretty common name and you're registering your website, like for a personal website for your business, say like John Smith, and you pick a weird, like johnsmith.info, is it possible that that could be trademarked and that could be taken from you?
You're asking if you can trademark a personal name.
Yeah.
Yes. And it has been something that's been controversial up until probably about 5 years ago. Can you trademark your own name? My name is Steve Reinhart. Can I trademark Steven Reinhart? And it's pretty well established now that you can. And I would say of all the domain name attorneys in the U.S., I'm the one that handles domain names involving personal names the most. Last year, I tried to take the domain name KendrickMoxon.com from someone. And Kendrick Moxon is the lead attorney, the head attorney in the Church of Scientology. Everybody's out to get him. He didn't know how to do these domain name disputes, even though he's a litigator. And so he asked me if I would take his personal name from this party that had it. And I was able to establish that he, Kendrick Moxon, had trademark rights in his own personal name and take the domain name from the person who registered it. I handled a domain name dispute over David Lee Roth last month. And I was actually defending the case. David Lee Roth, the lead singer of Van Halen, was trying to establish that he had trademark rights in his own personal name. And the case settled on favorable terms for my client. I can't disclose the amount. But it is possible to do that. And you can do it by registering a trademark on your own name or by simply showing you've been using your own name as a trademark.
What if it's two people with the same name?
That is a defense to trademark infringement. Or a defense to a UDRP case or an ACPA case. Not to use too many examples from my own practice, but I just settled a case here in Salt Lake last month where a company here in Salt Lake, or in Salt Lake that does over $1 billion a year in revenue, Savage Companies, was suing a woman in Seattle named Selena Savage, who owned the domain Savage Logistics. And they asserted, this domain name, Savage, incorporates our legal name. We want it. And her defense was, that's my last name. You can't take this domain from me. I registered it because it's my own surname. And it is a defense, but it's not a perfect defense. For the most part, personal names, or registering a domain that incorporates your personal name is a defeatable defense if there's another party out there that has senior rights, priority rights, and who's established a trademark in that name.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I think we have like a minute left.
It's easy for attorneys to ramble about these kinds of things, and I hope I haven't confused you all or bored you to death. But if any of you have any questions, email me or call me. I'm happy to answer them. And if you need help with this Australian domain name registrant, let me know.
Thank you.
Thank you, all of Ron and Stephen. Thank you so much. It was nice to meet you virtually. I'm sure you'll hear from some of them over time, but I really appreciate it. It was very interesting for me. I feel like I learned a few things for sure. And I guess we're done until the end of the year now. So our next